thank you for tuning in to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Mark Russo. We've got a great program planned for you tonight.
Today, we'll start off by discussing the efforts of peace groups in the Capital District with Joe Lombardo of Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace.
Then, we will discuss the federal tax bill with Ron Deutsch of the Fiscal Policy Institute.
Afterwards, we'll have a report from the rally at the state take to promote renewable heat, such as the increased use of geothermal in buildings to combat climate change.
And we finish with our regular sustainability piece, talking solid waste with Doug Bullock, Albany County Legislator. Let's start off the show with some rapid-fire local headlines.
The Rensselaer County Legislature is considering a proposal by the sheriff to increase its involvement with the federal effort to pursue immigrants. Meanwhile, WNYC is reporting Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, made almost 2,600 arrests in New York City during the last 12 months, a 40% increase over the prior year. Under President Obama, ICE focused mainly on arresting immigrants convicted of crimes, but immigrants merely charged but not convicted of crimes are now targeted by ICE, along with those who do not have legal documentation.
New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman is leading a coalition of 15 state attorneys general who have filed a suit against the Environmental Protection Agency for failing to meet the Clean Air Act statutory deadline for designating areas of the country impacted by healthy levels of ground-level ozone, commonly referred to as smog. At least one in three New Yorkers breathe air with unhealthy levels of smog pollution, with some analysis placing it as high as two in three New Yorkers.
The Rensselaer County budget adopted Monday night does not contain any property tax hike. Outgoing County Executive Kathleen Gimeno noted that 89 cents out of every $1 in the county budget goes to pay for various state-mandated programs, primarily Medicaid. Unlike other local governments, counties are the administrative arm of the state.
The pending decision by Donald Trump to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel is leading to a mounting storm of protest, especially in the Arab world. The Palestinian government warned that such a move would be considered a declaration of war. The U.S. is expected to begin its move to move its embassy to Jerusalem. Many foreign policy experts said such an effort would further undercut any potential role for the U.S. in brokering peace in the Middle East.
The Daily News editorialized in favor of Governor Cuomo signing a law to strengthen enforcement of the state's Freedom of Information Law, which is regularly ignored by government officials. For the second time in 2 years, Governor Cuomo is about to receive a bipartisan bill that slightly levels the playing field when those requesting documents believe the government's denial of a Freedom of Information request is so off base that they file lawsuits in hoping a judge will pry the government's records loose. The bill would make sure that attorneys filing the lawsuits get their fees paid by defendants whenever a judge rules that the government was wrong to keep records under wraps. That's it for the news headlines. Up first tonight, WOOC is going to do a regular segment on peace work here in the Capital District. Our first guest is Joe Lombardo with Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace, and he's also national co-chair of the United National Anti-War Coalition. So welcome, Joe.
Thank you, Mark.
Can you give us a brief overview of your work here in the Capital District with the peace community?
Well, I am one of the founding members and on the coordinating committee of Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace, which was founded right before the United States invaded Iraq in 2003. We had a meeting and a vigil and then various protests, and we've been going ever since because the wars have been continuing and expanding throughout the world. Ever since. We hold a weekly vigil on the corner of Delaware and Ellesmere in Bethlehem. We hold a monthly forum meeting, film showing or whatever, at the Bethlehem Library, and a whole series of other events, usually based upon the main event that's taking place in the world at the time.
So these are global peace issues, but can you talk about some of the key issues that the local groups in this area are focused on?
Well, there's a number of peace groups in this area. There's Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace, there's Women Against War, there's the Peace Action, there's Veterans for Peace, and a number of others. And typically, the peace groups today talk about the wars at home and the wars abroad because they're very connected. A number of soldiers who are over in fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or wherever, kicking down doors, maybe in the middle of the night in those countries, have come back and have been hired into police forces around the country. And there's been a militarization going on in the police where a lot of the equipment that from these wars has been coming back into the communities. You start seeing police officers no longer dressing in blue in some areas, but dressing in khaki uniforms. You've heard of police agencies characterizing people, especially in the black communities, as the enemy rather than people that they should be serving, just as they did in these wars abroad. We also see the attacks on immigrants as part of the war at home, the attacks on unions, and much, much more. The money that goes for war in this country is tremendous. It's close to what all other countries in the world pay for war, and that money should be used for human and social needs back at home. So the anti-war committees in this area and around the country these days talk about the wars abroad and the wars at home.
Now, you mentioned one of the things that the groups have been focusing upon is, attack on immigrants. And I know that particularly Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace had worked a number of years ago with a local imam who was basically kicked out as a chaplain in the prison system because of, his religious beliefs, and in the longstanding case of individuals associated with the mosque on Central Avenue being sentenced for many years in jail as part of a sting operation by, the federal government. How has the Muslim, issue evolved over the years here in the Capital District?
Well, in the beginning, a lot of these wars were characterized as the war against terror, and a lot of that was to build up a case against Muslims as being terrorists around the world. And so it became important for them to attack Muslims in the United States also, and they have done that, not just with the case of the Muslims at the Central Avenue Mosque, but there's been a number of others from that mosque and others in this area that have been attacked. And including the one in Delmar who you mentioned, which was Imam Umar, who we were able to help and get a good resolution of that case. But there are special Muslim prisons in the United States. They're called CMUs, Communication Management Units, and the government admits hundreds of Muslims have been picked up and put in these very restrictive, draconian types of prisons so that they can't communicate with other people and so forth. And part of this is to build a case against Muslims. And someone like Trump has taken that to the logical conclusion and says we need to have bans on people coming into the country. We need to have walls. We need to have other kind of institutions in place that keep immigrants and especially Muslims out of the country. And that's very much part of the anti-war movement. If you are going to oppose the war on terror abroad, you have to oppose the war on terror here.
Right. I guess in addition to wreaking havoc on those communities of Muslims in other countries, the war-ravaged countries, there's also damage happening to them back in the United States. And as well, the soldiers who are coming back, who may be coming into police forces and inflicting violence on other local communities, we also have a huge problem of veterans returning with drug disorders and PTSD. What are the peace efforts in this area dealing with that problem as well?
Well, there's a lot, and Veterans for Peace in particular nationally has played a big role in trying to help veterans that are coming back and demanding that they get the kind of services they need. But they're committing suicides at a very rapid rate. Those, too, are the casualties of war, and we have to understand that. The drug addictions that are taking place, Before the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, no heroin was coming from Afghanistan. Soon after, about 90% of the heroin that comes into this country is coming from Afghanistan. And they have drones, they have satellites, they can tell a car coming across a border from Pakistan to Afghanistan and send a drone after it. You don't think they can stop these poppy fields from growing and stop this this heroin? So a byproduct of war has always been situations with the veterans and PTSD and addiction, and that's affecting our entire country. There's an epidemic right now of opiate in our communities, and a lot of this comes from Afghanistan.
Now, certainly one of the hot button issues, almost a third rail issue in the Capital District, if not the country, has been the issue of Israel and, you know, its treatment of the Palestinian people. We have the president, apparently sometime this week, is going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, which, you know, previous governments have refused to do because the Palestinians also view that as their capital. How is the president's move on this going to impact upon the whole peace negotiations in the Middle East?
Well, it's going to destroy it. And the president did move on this today. He proclaimed that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. And he also announced that we would be moving the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. These are terrible moves, and they split apart any kind of possibility of negotiations. Because Palestine also considers Jerusalem their capital, and it also is a holy place for Christians. And the three religions there need to have access to it in a real way from their religious viewpoints. But this is a blow to the Palestinians. When Israel was first founded, which was a terrible idea, a terrible thing to do. I mean, there was a place in the world called Palestine, and there were people that lived there called Palestinians. And the United Nations, many, many miles away, decided, well, we're going to divide that and give half of it as a Jewish state and let the Palestinians have the other half of their country. Imagine if someone did that in the United States. They said, well, we'll take New York and California and Texas, and we'll leave you the rest or whatever, and we're going to put whatever population we want from around the world to come into there. But ever since that period in 1947, when there was about equal amounts of land going to Israel and to the Palestinian state, Israel has encroached upon that, and there's almost nothing left for a Palestinian state. Places like Gaza are open-air prisons. If a young kid gets a scholarship to a college outside in Europe or the United States, the Israelis decide whether they can leave or not. And the Israelis control that. The Israelis control where they can fish and what kind of products they can produce and what can come out and how much food will go into there and how much building materials will go into there. They do not have any control over their lives whatsoever. And this is just another terrible move in the direction of suppression of Palestinian rights. So not just in the Arab countries, but all over the world right today, demonstrations are starting, and they will be happening in the United States. The Palestinian Rights Committee in the Capital District is talking about holding an action in the next few days. Nationally, UNAC, the United National Anti-War Coalition, for which I'm the one of the national co-coordinators, will be holding a meeting on Sunday and will likely call demonstrations throughout this whole country. We have to stop this madman in the White House before he destroys our world.
Well, speaking of apocalypse, the local peace community has also reacted to the escalating conflict between the Trump administration and the now nuclear-armed North Korea. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah. Look, the United States, during the Korean War, the United States killed about a third of people in that country. They carpet bombed the country. They destroyed just about every building and then started bombing the dams like they did in Vietnam when they bombed the dikes. These are international war crimes. You're not allowed to bomb dams, even if you're at war, to try to flood the population and just kill as many people as you could. But the United States did that. And when the war ended, North Korea said, well, let's have a peace treaty? And the United States said, absolutely not. We still intend to take over your country. And the United States has refused to sign a peace treaty since the end of the Korean War. Twice the Koreans have entered into negotiations with the United States to stop their nuclear arms. In both cases, they stopped their nuclear programs. And in both cases, the United States did not hold up their part of the bargain. The United States has about 30,000 troops on the border with North Korea. It holds war games once a year, and these war games are really practice invasions of the North. When the United States was the only country in the world that had nuclear weapons, we used them twice. When other countries got them, it became a deterrent against the U.S. using them. The reason that North Korea is building nuclear weapons is because they know the United States continues to threaten them. And when Libya, the Libyan president Gaddafi, was building nuclear weapons, the U.S. said, look, if you stop, we promise not to invade you. They stopped, and the U.S. invaded them anyway. The North Koreans recognize that and see that. And that's why they're building nuclear weapons. They have never invaded another country since the Korean War. The United States has invaded countries over and over and over again. We have 20 times the number of foreign military bases as all other countries in the world combined. The reason that North Korea is doing this is to protect themselves. They are not the aggressor here. The United States has nothing to fear from them, but they have a lot to fear from the United States, and so does the rest of the world.
So, Joe, we only have time for about another 90 seconds. I'm going to give you two questions. You can answer whichever you prefer. One is, that any of our local congressmen or United States senators particularly bad or good on the peace issues that we wouldn't expect from a Democrat or a Republican? And then just if people want to find out more about the peace community here in the Capital District, what's the best way to try to keep informed?
Well, to find out about the peace community, you can go to Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace website, which is called bethlehemforpeace.org, or go to UNAC's website, the national one, which is UNAC Peace, UNACPEACE.org. And you can get information and sign up on our list there. There's others from other peace groups, which I don't have time for right now. But let me just say about the war issue. It is a bipartisan issue. Hillary Clinton was no better than Trump on this. In fact, she was worse on some things. She wanted to do a no-fly zone in Syria, which would have caused a crisis at a much rapid rate than is even happening now. I don't think you can depend upon either the Democrats or Republicans, and I think we need to build an independent peace movement in this country, and that's what we're trying to do.
Well, thank you so much, Joe.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking with Joe Lombardo of Bethlehem Neighbors for Peace and UNAC. Next week, we'll have a discussion with Jewish Voices for Peace.
So last Friday night, the United States Senate passed their version of the Republican tax cut. We discuss what happens next with Ron Deutsch of the Fiscal Policy Institute. This is Mark Dunley, and we're talking with Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, about the federal tax cuts that have been imposed by the president and by the Republicans in Congress. First, Ron, can you just give us a brief overview? What exactly is the Fiscal Policy Institute?
Sure. Pleasure to be with you here today, Mark. So Fiscal Policy Institute is a nonpartisan, independent economic think tank, and we work on state budget and policy issues that generally affect low to moderate income New Yorkers. We also work on federal policy, and in particular, we're pretty busy lately trying to decipher what the federal budget cuts and the federal tax policy is going to mean for New York.
Now, certainly the tax cuts that have been proposed by President Trump has been primarily viewed as a big tax giveaway to the wealthy, though, of course, many others do point out that over the years there are so many tax loopholes that it's, sort of Swiss cheese approach to tax policy, and probably some type of reforms are needed. But what are some of your biggest concerns with the president's tax proposal? Maybe just start off with a brief overview of what the president is saying he's trying to do.
Sure. So you listen to the president's rhetoric, and it becomes pretty obvious that he's trying, as what he would say or suggest, is trying to cut taxes for the middle class. I think, unfortunately, his tax plan fails on all accounts there. And this is a tax plan that's really put together by the president and the GOP leaders of Congress. So what this does is it shrinks the number of brackets down from 7 to 3. So there'd be brackets at 12%, 25% and 35%. Unfortunately, we don't know what income levels those are going to apply to, so we're a little perplexed there. It also eliminates the estate tax. It eliminates the alternate minimum tax. And it basically doubles the standard deduction that people who don't itemize would be taking, although that's questionable as well.
Now, one of the issues that particularly has come up here in New York is that the president is proposing that in terms of people who do itemize their tax deductions, that they would no longer be allowed to deduct the property and, I guess, income taxes they pay to New York State and other local governments. Why is that such a concern for New York?
So what the president's proposing is basically this elimination of state and local tax deductibility. That's been in place since 1913, since the advent of the federal income tax. So, you know, there's been efforts over the years to repeal that, replace that, get rid of it. So we're very concerned, obviously, for New York, because New York does have higher, is more of a higher tax state, right? So we're able to write off our property taxes, our state income taxes, and other taxes that we pay on our federal return, thereby reducing our both our state tax burden and, in effect, our federal tax burden.
Why do so many people view this as basically a tax giveaway to the wealthy?
Well, oftentimes the wealthiest do well under state and local tax deductibility, right? They pay, you know, not necessarily as a percentage of income, but they pay large dollar amounts in property taxes and certainly in income taxes. But, you know, the reality is this could have a disproportionate hit on New York State. And I think the feds are basically saying that this is unfair, right? That the federal government is basically subsidizing high tax states like New York, and we should absolutely remove this deduction. When in reality, quite the opposite is true, right? We just saw a report from the Rockefeller Institute that showed that in 2015 alone, New York sent $48 billion more to the federal government than we got back in services. So in reality, it's states like New York that are higher tax states that are, in fact, subsidizing every other state in the nation.
Well, one of the controversial proposals, I believe, by the president is to eliminate the estate tax. And, you know, I like to leave my son the house we have, hopefully, you know, some money left over before we retire. You know, what's the problem with getting rid of the estate tax?
So the estate tax is basically a tax that's paid by the top 0.2% of estates in this country. So, you know, does Donald Trump need a $4 billion tax cut right now? Because that's what it would do, basically, for him. So the estate tax is paid by very few people. It's for couples with estates valued over $10 million. So the vast, vast majority of New Yorkers aren't going to be hit by this at all. Yet somehow we feel that, you know, we have to eliminate this. You know, they like to call it the death tax, when in reality it's simply a tax on the estate that's left over after someone's death. So we should keep it in place. It's been in place for a long time. The way wealth is distributed in this country, it makes more sense to keep it in place. Otherwise, we're going to have even greater income inequality than we have now.
What are some of the proposals in terms of the tax cuts that the Fiscal Policy Institute is most concerned about?
Well, I think obviously we're concerned about two primary things. One is state and local tax deductibility, right? That's going to affect a lot of middle-income New Yorkers that itemize their deduction. So basically anybody who itemizes in New York State is going to get hit with this. The other piece is obviously just simply lowering the top tax rate in at the federal level from 39.6 to 35%. That is a huge boom for very wealthy New Yorkers. And we estimated between the estate tax and the lowering of the top tax rate, the top 1% of New Yorkers would see about a $20 billion tax windfall. You know, these are folks that have been doing exceptionally well in our economy and who have seen, you know, the vast majority of the income gains since the Great Recession. You know, to me, now is not the time to balloon the deficit, cut entitlement spending in order to provide the top 1% of this nation's wealthiest individuals a tax cut.
Now, even though the Republicans do control both houses of Congress plus the presidency, they've not exactly had many victories so far since Trump has taken office. So they seem a little desperate to win something to show people that it makes some sense to put him into power. What are the chances that we're going to see, you know, the type of tax proposals that Mr. Trump has put on the table actually get enacted?
You know, I'm very concerned that a number of these tax cuts could go through, but I think, you know, the New York congressional delegation, certainly the Republicans as well, would be hard-pressed to vote for a tax package that eliminated state and local tax deductibility. They know that they would feel the impact of that at the polls probably the next time they run for election. So I think there's going to be some serious pushback. My concern is that they do what they've tried to do with other pieces of public policy that they're trying to advance. They try and basically buy off various states through, you know, enticing them with different provisions. We saw this with the healthcare debate with Maine and Alaska. That's just a horrible, horrible way to make public policy. And as you know, the sausage making progress is never pleasant. But I think when you look at doing something like this, I think the New York congressional delegation just simply will not stand for it.
Now, of course, Senator Schumer here from New York is the Senate minority leader. Are the Democrats advancing, you know, their own proposals or trying to, come up with a different package of reforms?
You know, I think some of the Democrats on the Senate side have obviously been promoting a number of different ways to help from more of the bottom-up tax approach, you know, looking at expanding the child tax credit, looking at expanding the earned income tax credit. Those are things that make sense. They help struggling working families to boost their incomes. And in our completely consumer-driven society, the more money the people at the bottom have, the more they're going to spend. That benefits the wealthy. So we need to get away from this notion of trickle-down economics and start thinking about more of a bottom-up approach to our tax policy and our economic policy in the United States.
Now, along with the tax proposals, of course, are the president's budget proposals. Normally, you're supposed to adopt the budget by the end of the fiscal year, which I believe is October, but I know they've been cutting deals to push that deadline back. What's going on with that budget, and how is it looking in terms of people concerned about low and moderate income New Yorkers?
Yeah, so I'm very concerned about low and moderate income New Yorkers when it comes to both the House budget resolution and the coming Senate resolution as well. It looks like there are going to be massive cuts to a variety of different entitlement programs that had traditionally been federally funded for decades. Now they're going to look at shifting some of those costs to the states. So in particular around the food stamp program or the SNAP program, as it's called now, they're looking at transferring about 25% of those costs to different states. And New York would have to absorb about a $1.25 billion hit there. So you look across the board at the type of cuts that they're looking at making. You know, it's not just food stamps. It's a low-income home energy assistance program. It's the community development block grants. It's the public assistance programs. It's housing programs. It's just an endless list of programs that they're looking at slashing. And that's going to have a serious damaging impact, not only on our kind of physical and human infrastructure here in New York, but also on our fiscal situation. We're right now looking at like a $4 billion budget gap for next year. And you lay all these budget cuts from the federal government on top of that, it's a recipe for disaster.
We have just about a minute left. So if people want to get involved with this, find out more about what you guys are doing, how do they do that? But also one of the things it seems like Governor Cuomo keeps on crying wolf about is some type of hospital reimbursement program at the federal level may end, of course, the state billions of dollars and throw the state budget out of whack. What exactly is going on that in about 60 seconds?
So I think the reality is that everything that they're doing at the federal level right now is going to mess with our state budget in a very significant way. So Governor Cuomo is justifiably concerned at this point, and I think, you know, he needs to be shouting it from the rooftops that these cuts cannot go through. It would have a huge and detrimental impact on our state budget and require us to make cuts or come up with additional revenues in order to backfill those cuts. So if you want to learn more about what's going on in New York with the federal budget, you can certainly check out our website at fiscalpolicy.org. Or you can go to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities website, cbpp.org.
And we've been talking with Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and this is Mark Dunley. So WOOC will continue to provide you with updates on the federal tax bill and its impact on New York.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Mark Russo.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WWOC 105.3 FM Troy.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out online at mediasanctuary.org.
Now we're going to turn to a rally that took place today at the state capitol, the Renewable Heat Now rally, and we have about five different speakers. And we're going to take it away. Climate change activists gathered this week at the state capitol to call on Governor Cuomo to heat and cool buildings in New York State with clean, renewable energy. Buildings account for more than a third of the state's carbon footprint, far larger than the greenhouse gas emissions from producing electricity. The first speaker we hear from at the Renewable Heat Now rally is Laura Schindel of Food and Water Watch.
I'm Laura Schindel, an organizer for Food and Water Watch, and we fight for things that we can't live without, our food and our water. Today, we're here to demand that Governor Cuomo commit to heating New York with 100% renewable energy. It's never been clearer that we must move off fossil fuels. With Puerto Rico, the Caribbean, California, Texas, and Florida still reeling from tragic disasters worsened by climate change. It's time for strong leadership from Governor Cuomo. It's no longer good enough to be better than the climate denier in chief. And while we've seen an impressive number of climate-related press statements from the governor, we haven't seen near enough action to end our ruinous reliance on fossil fuels. We have the technology to make the transition to 100% renewable energy. We can harness energy from the earth, sun and wind to heat our homes, power our economy, and keep New Yorkers on the move. What we need is political will to make it happen. What we need is Governor Cuomo to be a true climate leader. We've taken on the fossil fuel industry numerous times and we've won. Together we built a movement that banned fracking, that stopped the Port Ambrose LNG facility, that halted the Constitution, Northern Access, and Valley Lateral Pipeline. Now we face our greatest challenge yet. Without swift and dramatic action from Governor Cuomo and other leaders, we face nothing less than climate catastrophe. So we've gathered here in Albany to continue the fight for our lives and those of our families and communities. Together, we demand that Governor Cuomo side with us, not the fossil fuel industry. Together, we will build a broad, diverse, and powerful movement from communities across New York. Together, we will end New York's reliance on fracked oil and gas. Together, we will stop the construction of a fracked gas power plant in the Sheridan Hollow neighborhood of Albany. Together, we will reach 100% renewable heat. Together, we will move off fossil fuels. Together, we will win.
Bill Nowick, the executive director of New York Geo, gave a short overview of what geothermal and renewable heat means.
We can do that. We will do that. We need to do that. In the 1800s, if you had wanted to heat your home, what would you have been using to do it? It would have been wood. In the 1800s until the late 1800s, when it would have switched to coal. And then in the mid kind of 1920s to 1950s, there was a big switch over from coal to liquid fossil fuels, to oil and gas. And that kind of branched off into natural gas, where at this point, the majority of homes, at least in our state, are heated with natural gas. There are transitions that have happened. Many of us have heated with natural gas for most of our lives. We think that's the natural way to do it. We can make those transitions, and we have made those transitions. I'm going to talk a little bit about heat pumps, not just geothermal, but air source heat pumps as well. And I wanted to start by showing this diagram. Basically, there are three facets to heating a building. And one is the fuel source. Another is the generator or the concentrator of heat. And the third is heat distribution. So when you think of your house, you have a heat distribution system. It might be forced air, it might be radiators, it might be radiant flooring, it might be a wood stove that radiates. But you've got that distribution system. That doesn't necessarily change when you make the transition from fossil fuel heating to clean electric heat pumps. What does change is these two pieces here. With conventional heating, this is all about extraction. This is pulling gas or oil out of the ground. This is building pipelines that our communities don't need. This is causing a lot of problems in terms of methane leaks, et cetera, et cetera. With heat pumps, that is eliminated. With air source heat pumps, there is something that's put on the outside of the building that sucks air in, pulls heat out of that air, and then pushes the cooler air out. This is during the heating system. With geothermal, there's a loop, and the loop is put in the ground. And the loop, in most cases, is a closed loop. So there's some water and some antifreeze in that loop. It just continually circulates in that loop. No chance of contaminating the ground, et cetera, et cetera.
Jessica Azoulay of AGREE, the Alliance for a Green Economy, gave an overview of the statewide campaign.
Here, because 38% of the greenhouse gases in New York come from burning fossil fuels in our buildings, most of it for heat. 90% of people in New York heat their homes with fossil fuels. But we are going to change that. We are here because fossil fuel companies are proposing gas pipelines and other infrastructure across New York, but we are going to change that.
Yeah.
We are here because utility companies are planning to expand their gas distribution networks and make ratepayers foot the bill to convert people from oil to gas. We are going to change that too.
Yes.
And we are here because even in 2017, at a time when our climate is at stake, we're down to the wire. Developers can still put fossil fuel heating in new construction projects, and we are going to change that.
Yeah.
We are here because there are alternatives. We can warm our homes without warming the planet. Renewable Heat Now is a campaign that advocates a rapid transition of fossil fuel heat and onto geothermal and air source heat pumps and other renewable heating technologies. Heat pumps are efficient, meaning they use less energy, and they can run on renewable electricity. Momentum is building as people learn about these alternatives. All over the state, people are looking for solutions, and they are looking to the governor to enact game-changing policies that will make heat pumps affordable and available for all. A little over a year ago, AGREE joined our allies across New York to advocate that Governor Cuomo sign a geothermal tax credit bill that was passed nearly unanimously by the state legislature. Governor Cuomo did end up vetoing that bill, but then he turned almost immediately around and enacted rebates for geothermal and later for air source heat pumps. Yes. Thank you for listening to the people who stood at press conferences across the state, who called your office and sent you postcards. And thank you for just last week signing the legislation to enable on-bill financing for geothermal heat pumps so that people can easily afford to make the switch by paying the costs over time on the energy bill. Now, Governor Cuomo, we need you to go bigger. We need to see approximately 126,000 people or buildings converting away from fossil fuels and onto heat pumps in order to meet the governor's 2030 greenhouse gas reduction goal.
Every year.
Every year, thank you. A transition of this scale requires the following policies, which are the Renewable Heat Now platform. We need expanded rebates for geothermal and air source heat pumps and additional incentives for low-income households so that every family and every business can afford to make the switch. We need building codes that ban fossil fuel heating in new construction by 2020.
Yeah.
We need an end end to the state's gas expansion policy, which incentivizes utilities and customers to switch from oil to gas for heating. Our utility companies should be enabling the switch to heat pumps instead. We can do this.
Next, we hear from Aaron Mayer, the former national president of Sierra Club.
The United States now stands alone as the only nation denying anthropogenic climate change. Backed by the plutocrats that right now has transformed our democracy to a plutocracy. And we right now are facing the greatest threat that calls upon every citizen to declare the radical act of taking matters into their own hands, as only American patriots can do. We must stand for renewable heat, renewable energies, renewables right now.
We finish up with Albany County Legislator Mert Simpson, who is co-chair of the new SHARE Coalition opposing Governor Cuomo's plan to put two new frack gas turbines on Sheridan Avenue in Albany to power the Empire State Plaza.
What we're asking the governor to do is use the current technology and resources we have to do geothermal and eliminate obsolete fossil fuels. We've met at least three or four times the leadership of SHARE with the New York Power Authority and OGS, and they have this variation of this PowerPoint presentation where they keep claiming that, well, it's not really feasible to use renewable energy. And so we point out that, well, in Muncie, Indiana, they have a 730-acre Ball State campus that fuels 47 buildings with geothermal energy. St. Patrick's Cathedral, the largest Catholic Gothic cathedral in the country, has gone geothermal. We have airports. We have Canadian installations that use cold water to use geothermal energy, and we have the Hudson River here available. So what we're saying to the governor is we demand a request for proposal for engineers who are familiar with geothermal technology to come up with practicable solutions so that our grandchildren will have to suffer, which I believe we're sadly almost past the tipping point, but if we're not, we certainly don't need to be going in the wrong direction.
This is Mark Dunley for WOOC.
That was our coverage of the Renewable Heat Now rally at the Capitol. We heard from Laura Schindel, Bill Nowak, Jessica Azule, Aaron Mayer, and Mert Simpson.
So up next is our sustainability segment. Kim Tatio of Troy Zero Waste interviewed Doug Bullock, Albany County legislator, first vice president of the Albany Central Federation of Labor, and delegate of the Troy Area Labor Council, about the current and future state of solid waste management in Albany and the region.
Doug, can you tell me a little bit more about yourself?
First of all, I just want to go off script here and announce that there's a boycott of the Albany Hilton. As a labor activist, that's what we're doing right now, joining the picket lines in front of the Hilton and encouraging people not to go to the Hilton. And we're having a rally on the 19th of December at the Hilton and doing a fundraiser for the employees who've been out without a contract for 4 years. And there's a lot of people that are canceling their reservations. We urge people to cancel any reservation that you have at the Hilton and boycott it for these employees until this owner negotiates a contract.
Thanks for letting us know about that. And that's the Hilton in Albany, correct?
Hilton in Albany, yes.
Okay, thanks. So can you tell me a little bit more about your interest in solid waste management, maybe your experience from the county legislator?
The county legislature, the Albany County legislature, first introduced a bill a couple of years ago on banning styrofoam. We passed the first bill, which banned styrofoam in Albany for large corporations like Dunkin' Donuts and other corporations that do food service styrofoam, which is waste styrofoam that gets in our gutters and in our landfill and doesn't dissolve, it doesn't recycle, it breaks down too easy, and it's another form of plastic. So it doesn't dissolve, clogging up our landfills. Recently, we had a proposal in Albany County for an anaerobic digester. But I just want to say that the total ban on styrofoam wasn't completed, first of all, because of the legislature voting it down. On the total ban, we're very disappointed at that vote. It's very close. But the second thing that came up was after that vote was an anaerobic digester proposal by the leadership of the Albany County Legislature, and we supported it. It's a very good piece of legislation in terms of what it will do with food waste. And that's food waste is probably one-third of our landfill. I'm being...
No, that's accurate. That's about right.
I'm close. And it can be easily composted and produced into something useful. And what we proposed is the anaerobic digester, which will be at the North Sewer Plant in Albany. It'll be set up there. We're doing a pilot program first. We do the pilot program with institutional food waste. Food waste comes from any large county or state or city institution or even large corporations that have food service and food waste, and comes down to the digester, which will be situated in the North Sewer Plant. It's legislation that's been passed. It's in operation in its first stages, and we're going to take a good look at it to expand it. It's very important that we expand this so that we can have some relief to the Albany landfill, which is over capacity, set to close in 2022.
Right. Something that I can speak to with the landfill is knowing that I think it's true that about one-third of what goes in the landfill is organic matter that can be recovered and either recycled for composting, which can go back to the earth, or the anaerobic digestion, which can be used for energy. So I think that's really amazing that people are – that's moving ahead, because that is part of the solution in conjunction with composting. And, you know, I was here earlier this month talking about composting. And, you know, even if anaerobic digestion is happening, we still encourage and want people to compost locally in their backyard. So if you've got that backyard device, keep it going. You know, this is really to help the larger institutions that may not, you know, be able to do composting in their backyard or community composting. So can you tell me a little bit more about what's happening with solid waste? Are landfills filling? Like, what's going on in the Albany region?
Well, in the Albany region, like I said, our landfill is, which is regional in some aspects, set to close at 2022. And, you know, I think this anaerobic digester project will help that in terms of the food waste not going to that landfill. It's an important project because you really have to have a digester to complete the cycle of composting food waste. And the north plant of the sewer system in Albany County is the best place because it's actually right next to the city old landfill where they bring the leaves down, and we have the leave collection. So the leaves and the food waste go together in a composting facility that should be situated right there. You know, that's my vision of where it should be situated, because it's right next to the the end distribution of those leaves, and you have to have that kind of mixture to compost adequately. And once that product is done, it not only it's a fertilizer, and it can be sold on the market. So, you know, that's important because you got a revenue aspect to it for the county. And revenue is really important in the county right now, and it's really important to look for other sources. And this would be a really good source for it. It also produces energy for the sewer plant, and that'll be immediate. The sewer plant will use the composting material to heat its facility, which is important, and to run the whole electricity on the facility, which is massive.
Sure. So to be clear, there are the issue is that landfills are starting to fill, and they're getting the landfill is proposed to close in 5 years. So I think often when people, you know, humans are going about their day and they just take something and they throw it away. We have this sort of out of sight, out of mind with our trash, but some of these materials can be recovered and recycled into something else. So food scraps is one of them. It's, we said it's like about a third. It's like heavy. And part of the solution is, it sounds like it's twofold. It sounds like in Albany, there is legislation moving forward for maybe composting and anaerobic digestion. I say that because they're slightly different, because anaerobic digestion is taking the food scraps to be turned into a sludge to become energy. And then composting is mixing it, like you said, with the browns, the leaves and all that to become a soil nutrient, soil-rich nutrient that can go back to the earth. So is that what's happening, just for my own just clarity?
Yeah, the composting end of it isn't happening until we have a composting facility.
Sure, but maybe that could be part of this. The anaerobic digestion is already a facility.
Right.
Oh, but you want to have both.
Yes.
Great. That's awesome.
We have to have both, and I think we can do it on a district-wide basis with food scraps, especially starting with the institutions first. And you're absolutely right. You know, the folks that are out there in the residences, they'll have to do their own, composting with their leaves individually until we can get a system in place. The system's not in place, and we need it badly.
And, well, they can actually also compost their food scraps in their backyard, and there's lots of resources about that. And you can always check out the Troy Zero Waste people for our website for information on that, or reach out to us. We're really happy that you've been part of, you know, making these moves forward, and it's exciting about the anaerobic digestion. We hope that the second prong of composting can happen on a larger scale. What are the challenges with this? Like, are we headed towards a crisis in a few years if these landfills keep filling? And what's the proposal in addition to the anaerobic digestion and maybe composting in the future? Like, what's happening? Will there be higher costs for dumping? Like, maybe kind of break that down, because I'm not sure everyone always understands exactly what happens to the trash when you put it away, when you throw it in the trash can. Like, what does it mean with the landfills filling?
Well, when you throw the trash in your trash bin, it's mostly those things that aren't recyclable. And then there's only certain things you throw in the recyclable bin, which is of different colors now and forms. Very few plastic cans, bottles, and, it's not enough. There's a lot of things that go down to the Port of Albany at the recycling facility that don't get recycled. So everything that doesn't get recycled goes back to the landfill. So, that process has got to be cleaned up. We haven't really cleaned up our recycling system. It's very poor in Albany. I'd say it's poor in almost all the cities, including Troy and Schenectady and Saratoga. I mean, we have to really reevaluate our recycling system, or we're going to drown our landfills. I think it's at a crisis right now. If we don't do something different, if we do business as usual, we are going to pay and pay big, much bigger in the future for maintaining a landfill. And right now the proposal in Albany is transfer stations. And if we have are transfer stations that truck the waste to another facility hundreds of miles away, that's going to be even more costly. So we haven't got anything new on the agenda right now, and we need to put it there. We need to get serious about it in every city in the Capital District.
Okay, so it sounds like recycling is something that people, it can be hard, and some material that even if people are doing their part in trying to sort material for recycling, some of it can't actually be recycled because of the recycling facility. It's not able to handle it.
Food service styrofoam cannot be recycled. It breaks down, it goes into the dump, and it clogs it. You can easily recycle packaging styrofoam, but the issue is right now you're just throwing all this styrofoam into the landfill and clogging it up even more.
Right, and the styrofoam gets kind of bulky, and it's like it adds takes up a lot of space, and so
it takes up a lot of space because of its bulk. It's not weighty, and that's you know, the weight is the thing that the industry plays with and tries to justify that it's hardly anything into the landfills, but it's a big thing. When we did the legislation through Albany County, every single industry representative and lobbyist was there to shoot it down, and that's partially why it got shot down. And they took up most of the time on the speaker's end of it and, you know, drowned out the community that really wanted to ban styrofoam food service in Albany.
Okay. Well, can you tell us more about, you know, we talked about some of the solutions for maybe higher level for either anaerobic digestion, composting, improving the recycling, but what can people do in the local level? Like, what can we do from the grassroots?
From the grassroots, you should try and do composting with your leaves and with your food waste. And I know it's hard. People got to get the information. We got to get it out there to everybody. It's only getting to people like me and a few of us others. We got to start it on a mass basis. On a residential basis, because we're not going to get any immediate help on that in the future. We're, you know, they're going to do institutions first, and they should. You know, residences should try and recycle with their, with their leaves, with their lawn bags, if you have to, or put it in a bucket that can be sealed where. And, you know, that there's multiple ways, which you much know much better than I do, Kim. And so, you know, people should still attempt to.
Yeah, try it out on your own. The microbes are your friends and will help break that stuff down for you. Is there anything else you want to tell us?
No, I think, you know, we got a long way to go in Albany before we solve our landfill problem. And we have to do it, as soon as possible. I just am hopeful in the future that this anaerobic digester system works out and that we can start in mass this food service waste disposal the correct way and out of our landfills. But, we got to do this immediately. It's going to cost local governments everywhere.
It also seems like these have big implications for our environment and the places that we live. So hopefully we can all work together and make it better.
Big implications for the environment, Kim. I agree.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
That was our regular sustainability section talking about solid waste in the Capital District.
That concludes our show. Once again, we hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Mark Russo. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news.
To learn more about this program and how you can support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, feel free to visit our website at mediasanctuary.org.
And if you'd like more information on how you can participate in the production of this program or have suggestions on stories you'd like to hear about, email us at mediasanctuary.org.
If you're interested in being a part of the radio crew here, we hold weekly meetings on Mondays and Thursdays night after the show at 7:07 p.m. You can come by the Sanctuary for Independent Media located at 3361 6th Avenue, in beautiful Troy.
The next episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine will feature Lorenz Warden of the Albany Bike Coalition, along with our special blend of local stories you won't find anywhere else. Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you next time.